book is Barman, Ping Pong Pathos and Passing the Bar. If you would like more information about the Morning Show podcast, you can subscribe through any of the major platforms, including Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. I am sure that you have heard of one of the most important singers in all the world, Bono, the lead singer for the group U2. Chances are either you are a fan or at least you know of Bono and his incredible importance, not only as a musician, as an artist, but also as an activist and humanitarian. In fact, it's hard to think of another professional musician before the public today who has a higher profile and more significance in terms of making a mark on the world. We're going to be talking today on The Morning Show about a book that takes a most illuminating look at Bono and kind of what makes him tick, and examines in particular his beliefs, his principles, and what sort of guides the choices that he makes when it comes to his work as an activist and humanitarian. The book is titled Religion Around Bono, and it is written by Chad Seals, who is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. And previous to this, he wrote a book called The Secular Spectacle, Performing Religion in a Southern Town. And this newest book is published by Pennsylvania State University Press. Professor Chad Seals, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. Really appreciate you for having me on the show.
I'm excited about this. Your book is absolutely fascinating. I should say that I come to this as more of an opera fan, more of a Mozart, Beethoven person musically. So I am not in any way really a fan of Bono as a musician, but certainly I have been intrigued by his significance and the work that he has done. And it has been very, very interesting to read about him in your fascinating new book. I think one important matter to get out of the way is to help us understand the rather curious-sounding title of the book, Religion Around Bono. Evidently, this phrase represents something that has been explored in a number of different books before this one, specifically about Bono. Explain those words, Religion Around Bono.
The Religion Around phrase is part of a series with Penn State University Press, in which there's now 7 books published in the series, and there'll soon to be more. And it looks at it takes a figure that most people might think of as not necessarily religious in itself, and oftentimes what would common sense be classified as a secular person, figure, and studies that as a religious subject, looking not just the figure, but the religious weather, the atmosphere around the figure. And one of the clearest examples of that kind of approach in the series is Tracy Fezzenden's book, Religion Around Billie Holiday. There's also books on religion around Shakespeare, Virginia Woolf, Emily Dickinson, and mine is the Religion Around Bono is the only book about a figure that's currently alive. So it's a different kind of dynamic. And Bono's sort of multi-tiered connections to both evangelicalism in Ireland as well as the work he does in Africa. It gives it a kind of broader scope in some ways than you might get from other figures. But the series in general is really looking at a way to talk about icons in relation to the study of religion.
Maybe you could explain a little bit about how this particular project, this book, folds rather nicely into your own personal background and also your own professional interests. I think both of those matters make this a really good match for you.
Yeah, exactly. My own personal history is I grew up in the Panhandle of Florida in Pensacola, grew up in this landmark missionary Baptist tradition as a kid, and then went to the bigger downtown First Baptist Church. So I really followed this path of fundamentalist evangelicalism into a kind of into really this upwardly mobile economic of the 1980s and 90s group of evangelicals who went from sort of rural farmers in the 20th century to the living suburban middle-class lifestyles. And so that my own personal history was really tied to white evangelicalism in the South, its connection to politics in the 1980s. And then my generation was turning to U2. I grew up in the late 80s and 90s in middle school and high school and became a fan of the music and of U2. And they were offering an opportunity for kids like myself who grew up in these evangelical worlds that were really tied to conservative politics as a way to resist, as a way to get out without actually having to change anything you did about yourself necessarily. It was more that the music of U2 was engaged in that evangelical tradition in a ways that were not apparent or evident to our parents themselves. So I remember distinctly the first time I ever heard of U2 was leaving our church on a Wednesday in service, and then and walking across the parking lot, and then running into some other. I was walking with my mom and running into some other moms of kids a little older than me, and they were talking about this band U2. Who are they? Are they Christian? Are they not? And they were talking about their kids had the Joshua Tree album that has biblical references, and so there was this mystery from the very moment I ever heard of U2: is are they Christian? Are they not? And so for a kid growing up in this evangelical world in which some music is acceptable, like evangelical musicians like Michael W. Smith, and then some music is totally out of bounds, like Rolling Stones, which when I was a kid, even in kindergarten, I went to Pensacola Christian School for kindergarten, and I distinctly remember being 4 years old, so it must have been a severe memory in which a kid had a, his name was Jeremy, had a Rolling Stones shirt on, and the teacher said, that's the devil's music. And so these classic tropes of evangelicalism resisting rock and roll and having acceptable forms of rock and roll. Well, U2 came in and blew that all up by, in a sense, offering something that didn't seem acceptable to the parents, but in fact continued this evangelicalism in a new form that appeared to be resisting the system. But the later on that I went in school and I studied philosophy in undergrad, went on to study American religious history, and I was just struck so much by how Bono's connection to evangelicalism was something that people were starting to pay attention in sort of confessional circles. But within globalization theory, I was taking courses in that. His work in Africa was either being celebrated or severely critiqued, but with no attention to religion. So it seemed like those two parts needed to come together somehow. His connection, Bono's connection to religion, to evangelicalism and its history, and also his global work in regard to Africa in terms of the complex layers of economics and foreign policy with the advocacy work he was doing. So that, in a sense, was the story that led to this connection to study how that works, how religion around Bono is not just about evangelicalism, it's also about neoliberal capitalism.
I'm glad you told the story of your first encounter as you did, because you included a detail that you do write about, but it had slipped my mind. And that is the fact that the first time you heard anything about U2, it was from two moms, and their conversation was one of, in a sense, concern. That is, they were asking each other rather pointed, concerned questions about what was this group all about, and were they a Christian group? And so right from the start, in a sense, Bono and U2 represented something, I should think, maybe kind of mildly dangerous to you.
Absolutely. And I think this gets at one of the things I try to think about is how the sort of obvious forms of classification in a religious world like evangelicalism of what's Christian and what's not. Is that good music? Is that bad music? Those are moral distinctions that we are separating out, and when I was in that world in particular, separating those out into groups. So this is good music and bad music. As a kid, of course, you don't want to go with your parents' classification system, right? You want to find your own version of what's morally good and what's morally bad that may at a time seem rebellious. And that's exactly what happens of this demographic that was this, which is now more broadly spiritual but not religious, who are resistant to established religion, organized religion's way of organizing the world and classifying it as good and bad in terms of is it Christian or is it not. And so one of the things that younger evangelicals, and by that I mean folks that are in the 80s and 90s shifting away from the religious right and taking up these causes towards Africa, is to not, they want to classify the world different in terms of its moral goodness, and they look at social issues of concerns in Africa as a way to do that. And so if you think of evangelicalism as giving the template and the most moral religious terms, and then what Bono does is take that template and applies it to the consumer world, and now you can discern a good product from a bad product, not just good Christian music from bad devil's music. You can now know that that Red Campaign product, a product stamped red on behalf of a cause in Africa, is now a morally good product. So it's replacing one system with another, which is really fascinating to me, because it overlaps with the spiritual but not religious group who's resistant to organized religion, who looks to escape it, but then finds a new form of organized religion, even though it's not by that name, within their consumer habits and practices.
We're speaking with Chad Seals and talking about his book, Religion Around Bono. This might be as good a time as any for the sake, especially of listeners who don't really have direct acquaintance with Bono and YouTube. I mean, who don't listen to their music and or follow their exploits very closely, to maybe describe their music, what it sounds like, and also its message, and a little bit more about the way in which they are, in a sense, a very, very much a very spiritual group, in a way that is not very typical for rock groups, but drawing the line that keeps them from being, for instance, conventionally religious.
Yeah, the arc of U2 in terms of its music is that it comes out of, it's associated with a punk scene early on, but even at the very beginning, both Bono and The Edge and Larry Mullen Jr., three of the key members of the band, and Adam Clayton, they're all key members of the band, but Adam Clayton was outside this world, but those three were in a group called Shalom, which was a confessional evangelical group that looked to withdraw from society, to share its possessions and what it saw itself in the image of the early Christian churches. And then at one point they almost convinced Bono and The Edge to not pursue the band U2, and famously their manager Paul McGinnis convinced them to stick with the program and stay in the band. And later on, Bono remembers his time in Shalom as being part of a group that was really naive. And so what Bono does is extract evangelicalism, and it's key here to realize that evangelicalism is a small demographic slice of Ireland. Its Protestant Catholic history is really against Anglicans, Church of England, Church of Ireland, against Catholics. And Bono, his own life history that is really influential to his artistic creativity is that his parents were on both sides of that broader religious divide between Catholics and Anglican Protestants. And he saw in their parents their love for each other as transcending that religious conflict in organized institutional terms. And he loses his mother at a young age. When she dies, and he remarks that the death of his mother is the source of all of his really artistic creativity. So there's this attempt at the very beginning to find a love that transcends religious conflict, and that ultimately is mapped onto the evangelicalism as a history, which evangelicals will often say, we're not religious. We don't have religion. What we have is faith. What we have is love. We are Christians in this broad sense that's not attached to any institutional organized religion. So that's at the base of Bono's artistic creativity, which filters through the music between himself and Edge. They put in the message of the music, they put into the music what they call drawing fish in the sand, which are biblical allusions. They will rework sacred songs like Bach, for example, and Magnificat and Magnificent for their version of it. And so if you want to describe U2 music broadly, it's got hidden, it's like open secrets, these openly hidden messages within it that for some fans who want to find them can find them. For some who don't, they don't pay attention. And then the arc of the music moves from this kind of punk, edgy, sort of against the world sound and evolves into what you get in the Joshua Tree is this transcendent, spatial, spiritual landscape in which they look to expand and literally through the music, this transcendent, and then later on in like songs like Elevation, the purpose here is to sort of move away from the ground and move to these ethereal spaces that are closer to heaven in an aesthetic sense. And so that's really, when you map the arc of U2's music, now, of course, they experiment with Octune Baby and this more Euro-pop sound in sort of the mid part of their career, but they return back to the kind of transparency of this sort of evangelical spirituality after that, and particularly that gets attached later to Bono's work in Africa. So in sum, you could say what U2's music is you could characterize it as caring rock. It's rock and roll that's transcendent. It's for a higher purpose.
I think it would be interesting to also understand what happens at a typical U2 performance that is beyond the singing of the actual songs and whatever messages might be couched in the lyrics. How, in what way are direct references made by Bono and anyone else who speaks during their performances in terms of referencing these messages and talking about them openly, forthrightly?
Yeah, one thing to understand Bono's performance in concerts is to think back to how Billy Graham used media, technology, television, and concerts. His were rallies, and Billy Graham's goal was to get you to convert to his message of salvation of your soul. And what Bono is doing is positioning himself more subtly in that revival tradition. And he will say in a concert, ask his audience out loud, have you been to church? And then answer his own question by saying, this is church. So what he does is take these evangelical revival traditions that go way back in U.S. history, all the way back to Western Europe, over 200 years. But if you look at a figure like Charles Finney in the 1830s, and what Finney does is shift revivalism away from what earlier Jonathan Edwards said was a miracle of God. It was God's work. You couldn't make a revival happen. It just happened in its own terms under God's providence. And then Finney says, no, a revival is not a miracle in the 1830s. And this is at the height of industrialization. So what Finney is doing is saying that a revivalist is like a farmer. They can look at the fields, and you don't just, as a farmer, look at the fields and just wait for stuff to grow. You have to have a method. You plant. And God may bring the sun and the rain, but you as the farmer, like the revivalist, have agency. You can make these things happen. And Finney famously developed techniques to convert people. One of them was the anxious bench, in which if you were at an outdoor gathering, a revival, and Finney's up front, and he would say to the audience, the crowd, if you're contemplating your salvation, whether you're going to heaven or hell, come sit on this bench and we'll pray for you. So it was a form of peer pressure, bringing someone out in public and calling them out. And then what Bono does, if you look at the history of his concerts, he's looking to connect to you physically as a performer, more so than other rock performers like to connect to the audience. But Bono looks to even take it even further and connect more physically. And then he looks to bring the audience in to convert them to his cause. And it's not to convert your soul. So he's not looking to save your soul necessarily, but he's looking to convert the audience to his cause, which later on becomes these causes in Africa. And so he uses the techniques that Finney perfected early in the 1830s that sort of mark the agency of revivalists. And he'll do things like, it's called his Messiah headband, where in the Vertigo tour, he's got the symbols of monotheism on his head, and says, we're all wearing this band on his head, and we're all children of Abraham. He has these sort of sermonic messages woven in to the songs and between the songs. And then he would start bringing politicians to his concerts to convert them to causes to Africa. Like Bill Clinton's in the house with the Beastie Boys at a show in New Jersey, and he's going to convert them to his cause in Africa. So there's these multi-layered things going where he's taking the church outside of the church in the sense of he doesn't see himself as church within an organized space. And to this day, he will not attend a church service that's ongoing, but he will take his family into that building after the service is over. So for him, it's a way of taking the message of evangelicalism, of Christianity at its core, of love, that's not going to force you to convert to in terms of your soul, but it's going to ask you to convert to his higher transcendent cause, which he later on, within the last 2 decades, has been directed towards Africa.
Mm-hmm. At several points during the book, as you discussed and describe Bono and what he is doing and the role that he is playing, the term prophet is used over and over again. Help us understand the way in which this term fits Bono, and particularly the way in which you are describing him, the way in which you see him as some sort of prophetic figure.
I use the term prophet in a sociological sense. I'm really borrowing it from the sociologist Max Weber, in which Weber distinguishes between two types of charisma. If you look at the history of Christian churches, you've got the charisma of the priest, which is office charisma. So it doesn't matter whether the priest has a great personality or not. Their authority comes from the church as an institution. And then you've got the prophet as a figure that stands outside the protections of the institution and then critiques it from outside and so speaks back to the institution. And that person's authority as a prophet is really based on their own personal charisma. So they constantly have to perform their personality, their authority in speech, and in Bono's case, in concert. And the authority of that kind of prophet is solely dependent on the people to recognize it. So in a sense, the power of that kind of prophet doesn't come from an institution. It comes from the people, in this case, the fans, who consent to say that you are a prophet. And what fascinated me the most is I was surprised. I mean, I'd heard a few fans of Bono say he's prophetic or he's like a prophet. But the closer I read in terms of evangelical reactions to Bono, Christian responses to Bono, confessional fans talking about Bono, they didn't say he's like a prophet. They repeatedly said over and over, he is a prophet. So there's a way in which Bono has been recognized as prophetic. And as an icon that's such a global figure, that he's mocked for those kind of things. So on one side, everyone says, oh, Bono thinks he's a prophet. He thinks he's the Messiah. He's got this God complex. And so there's this side that's sort of recognizing it through their mockery. And then there's this other side that sincerely believes, or at least they confess sincerely to his ability to be a prophet, not just like a prophet, is a prophet. So that for me was really striking in terms of how Bono is recognized as prophetic and has, unlike Billy Graham, who would be connected to a confessional tradition, Bono has this ability to speak to people connected to a confessional tradition and to be recognized as such as prophetic, particularly among the sort of emerging church evangelicals in the U.S., and then to not be recognized as religious by many fans who see him as spiritual, but then not religious in that way.
One of the things I find most intriguing is the manner in which Bono rejects organized religion, because it seems to me that the most common way that tends to happen is either someone rejects it all, I mean, is an atheist or agnostic or whatever, or rejects organized religion in favor of crystals or holistic medicine or pantheism or, I mean, other sort of spiritual practices which tend to have absolutely nothing to do with organized religion or doctrine or a church building or any of those kind of traditional trappings of what we think of as religion. And certainly the typical person, I think, that rejects organized religion would not go around quoting the words of Christ and talking about Christ and calling himself a Christian and so on. I just find that kind of intriguing, the array of choices that Bono is making. And those things that he specifically rejects and those things which he not only retains but which he talks very openly about. Do you find that at all curious as well, or is that kind of thing more common than I realize?
No, that's a really great point, Greg, and that's a really nice way to frame it because it is a bit baffling. There, if reflecting on it a little bit, if you wanted to say there's exactly as you're saying, there's these folks who you think of resisting organized religion who are not really looking to create new religion. They might be looking to create new forms of personal spirituality or to escape the trappings of organized religion, but their goal is, in a sense, to not make new religion. But Bono is, in effect, I think, and that's why I think he's in this prophetic tradition. If you think of within Christianity, he's making new forms of Christianity under broader names. So if, in the history of religions, you have this movement away from particular sectarian traditions into broader kind of, you almost think of it as civil religion, like nationalism, that is able to take Christianity and to infuse it into symbols of a nation state, which is the story of the U.S. And can be the story of other places like Germany and in a possibly negative sense. But you're exactly right. Like, what seems strange about Bono is that he's resisting church, but then says to his fans, this is church. So there's that kind of strangeness to me is a signal that there's something going on more than just rejecting religion. Bono's, in fact, invested in making new religion as, at the very same time, he says he doesn't want that label. He says, I don't want it. I'm not calling it religion. And there's also, and later on, I think a lot about how the racial dynamics of those kind of saying you are, aren't something while practicing it, is tied to the sort of racial traditions of minstrelsy in the United States to sort of claim blackness and say you're not black in a type of performance. So you're exactly right. I mean, it's just, it is something strange going on about Bono's rejection of religion as he's diffusing it into new forms of consumption, of fans, communities, and these concerts. So that's a really, really helpful thing to think about.
We're speaking with Chad Eseals about his book, Religion Around Bono. I want to return for a moment to something that we kind of grazed past a little bit earlier in the interview, and that is your own personal relationship to Bono when you were younger, as someone growing up in the South in a Baptist family. And for you, what the music of Bono and YouTube represented, and you talk about this quite a lot in your book, the fact that for you and for some of your peers, this was, in a sense, a very safe way to rebel or to be a bit of a rebel without engaging in any of the overt activities that your parents would have really found unacceptable and probably had no personal interest for you. But this was a way to, in a sense, achieve the same sort of thrill of stepping outside the careful boundaries that had been set by your parents, by your pastor, and others. Talk more about how this was true for you.
Yeah, that's a great question, Greg. And it's sort of multi-layered, and there's sort of a lot of different sort of emotional and historical layers that go all into it, which is to say that to rebel for Bono is this feeling of having grown up in evangelicalism, particularly white evangelicalism. And you look at the history of white evangelicalism, and early on in the history of evangelicalism in America, it was extremely radical in terms of it had this radical democratic impulse in which anyone could preach, which meant whether you're black, white, woman, male, you could preach. And so this disruption of authority had the potential to make radically new communities, which did happen early on in the American Republic, is that evangelicalism was a mixture of freed slaves and a mixture of different ways of organizing family, and it had direct economic implications. Over time, white evangelicalism takes that radical democratic impulse and builds its own institutions around it that are for white gain and white economic mobility. Now, I grew up in that exact story. I grew up in a story in which my family comes from southern Mississippi. Grandmother was a sharecropper. By the time I'm in high school, I'm with a bunch of doctors and lawyers' kids in this downtown Baptist church, and we're all going to college. And so we've moved up economically. Well, when you're in that position and you come from a tradition that sees itself as a radical outsider, and that's one of the hallmarks of evangelicalism globally, is no matter how much power it has, it will always see itself as out from the outside. So even when President Bush is in office and has an evangelical coalition that puts him in the presidency, evangelicals still see themselves as persecuted and outside of power. So once you get into power and when your whole tradition has been seen from the outside, well, how do you get this feeling of rebellion of being an anarchist? Because there's a connection of evangelicalism to a kind of anarchist tradition, well, how do you get that feeling of being an outsider? Well, you look to people who are outsiders, and that's exactly what Bono did, but I didn't know it at the time. So Bono is speaking these prophetic languages in the name of being against apartheid in South Africa. So while I'm driving to my downtown white Baptist church, and we're passing in this downtown space African-Americans in their houses, in which the church will soon buy up those houses to build a parking lot to expand, like, how do you feel like an outsider in that situation? Will you start to speak as if you are an outsider? And Bono gave that kind of voice. And the kind of prophetic voice that he had on stage was something that I, at the moment, wanted to speak. But that is also a technique of blackface. That is what the history of evangelicalism does, is white evangelicals taking the voice of African-Americans in particular and speaking as if they're like them, as if they're outsiders. And you see this most directly in the 1980s with the rise of the religious right after the civil rights movement, is that you have folks like James Dobson, this conservative Christian psychologist, who goes to Birmingham to defend a judge who's bringing the Ten Commandments into his courtroom, trying to drive it in on the back of a truck. And James Dobson says that evangelicals, white evangelicals, are like Rosa Parks on the back of the bus. So what Bono tries to do is say, I'm not speaking like James Dobson, but in the end, what baffled me now, having studied all this stuff, is that he gives the feeling that he's against the religious right. He gives the feeling that he was against Reagan. He gets the feeling that he's against all these conservative Christians. But if you look at the net effects of that economic policy, that's really a feeling of rebellion without changing who you are. And so there, as a kid in high school, there's little you could do, right? You can't change, you can't become a socialist and join a labor union before you even started working. But you can act crazy by your own physical decisions of what you do with your body and what that's out, prohibited by your parents. So that's a form of anarchy in itself. But Bono gives this sort of feeling of rebellion without even having to act in those kind of ways as outbursts or directly. But that translates into what is really happening is Bono speaks as if he's challenging the system, when in fact is doing more economically in terms of globally diffusing neoliberal policies that do away with public goods and social services, that privatize them. So even in those sparks of feeling rebellious without actually doing anything, that's the kind of snapshot of what the big picture effect or net effect of this rebellion looks like. It's a rebellion that in the end speaks as if it's on behalf of those who are poor, but in effect bolsters the wealth and prosperity of those who are already wealthy. So it's this strangeness in which it feels like you're doing something, but in fact you're really not.
It's not as rebellious as it might immediately seem. I want to just read one portion of when you're describing kind of your first sensations as you became interested in U2. You wrote, for the church-going teenager, listening to U2 was an easy way to rebel. You didn't have to do or change anything. You didn't have to drink or smoke, get a piercing, or dress differently. U2 made it cool not to do those things. They made it cool to stay the same. In a sense, that's a perfect segue into what is really, in a sense, the central premise of the book, and you were just touching on it. The fact that for as revolutionary as Bono might appear to be and maybe even describes himself as being, the change that he wants to see in terms of bettering the lives of the poor around the world is almost entirely to be accomplished through the systems that already exist. Even systems, economic and sociological systems, that have to a large extent created and fostered the very injustices that he wants to address. Explain to our listeners, in a sense, your evidence for this, or the clear objective evidence there is that this, in fact, is true. What are the ways in which Bono, for all of his revolutionary trappings, chooses to work within systems that already exist that he appears to not want to change?
Yeah, that is a really good question, Greg, because it's one of the hardest things to have a conversation around, because from where we sit on our side as consumers, it's very difficult for us to see what's actually happening on the ground in terms of economically in Africa. But I'll give you two quick examples that may help readers and listeners sort of say this is some evidence to maybe say I should look more into this. The first is that if you look at what happened in South Africa with the World Cup, and Bono was promoting the World Cup, he was singing with the Soweto Gospel Choir, just similar to how he sung with the Harlem Gospel Choir early on in his career. And he's singing songs of this message of transcendence, of hope, of love, in a post-apartheid Africa. There are Christian images woven into the promotional videos for ESPN. It's this vision of from Dr. King's America to Nelson Mandela's Africa. So this journey of equality is leading to more racial justice across the globe. So this is a beautiful narrative. It's one, as global citizens, we hope to believe in. But if you look at the economic impact below that narrative, there are a couple of things that are striking. At the moment that Bono is singing with the Soweto Gospel Choir, the electricity company Eskom that had been privatized post-apartheid. So during apartheid, there are all these protections around the company to make sure the electricity is affordable, but only available to white consumers. So two things happen after post-apartheid. One is electricity is opened up to all customers, all consumers, regardless of race. So that is indeed progress, that everyone is now included in the market and has access. But at that very moment, market protections are taken away from the company. And as it's privatized, its ability to survive in a global economic market is greatly threatened. And the only way it can survive is to raise prices. So at the moment that electricity, the very company that's powering the World Cup, that's putting electricity on stage in which Bono is performing, is also raising prices as a matter of survival, and such that poor customers, black customers in South Africa, in Soweto, can't afford the electricity. So the only way they can have electricity is to do illegal, the company starts, when they can't pay, Eskom starts cutting off electricity to residents of Soweto. So they band together and start an organization to illegally reconnect electricity. And to protest, they start disconnecting electricity to politicians in the to show them what it feels like to lose their power, literally lose their power. So Bono never speaks of those dynamics. He's never once up on stage and says, look, the Eskom electricity company is raising prices that do not allow poor customers to have access to electricity. He doesn't speak of those issues at all, which are a direct impact of the economic policies he promotes. So there are multiple layers. So it's difficult to point to Bono and just show him with the smoking gun to say, like, he's the one responsible. He's part of a system that creates conditions, that creates poverty. And the solution is to not change the system to create market protections for all, that's the important thing to remember, whether it's in the U.S. or globally, whites had market protections and continue to do in many ways, more so than others. But they particularly, before World War II, had market protections that allowed them to take advantage of the economic system. And that's a whole complex layer to the story, but that's just one example. And one other quick example is that the Red Campaign, which takes products, marks them as red, the proceeds are sent to Africa, though we as consumers don't know how much money goes where. It's not transparent at all. But we are told that this money goes to causes in Africa, particularly mosquito nets for malaria, antiretroviral drugs for HIV and AIDS. But what scholars have shown is that those proceeds, in effect, like a mining company in South Africa, rather than paying for healthcare for its employees out of its own profits, or rather than that mining company being taxed by the government to pay for healthcare for all, what a company like that is doing is using the proceeds from the Red Campaign, who are basically good-hearted people, citizens of the West and the U.S. and Europe, are buying these products. And then that company, rather than paying for the healthcare, uses those proceeds to pay for that healthcare for its workers, to make them better workers and able to show up, have better health to show up to their jobs. And then, in a sense, subsidize the profits, in effect, subsidize the profits of those companies. So that the net result is that consumers like ourselves are being taxed, in effect, by our goodwill. We want to help other people. And by trying to help other people, we're in effect subsidizing profit margins for these multinational corporations. So it's difficult to point to one thing, but if you put all the layers together, it's that feeling of rebellion without actually changing the system. So it doesn't solve the, it doesn't create conditions that alleviate poverty in its entirety. It creates possibilities of solving parts of poverty. Like entrepreneurship does work. Capitalism does work. It just doesn't work for everybody. And if there's not a social safety net, as we see in this moment of pandemic, then businesses will fail. Entrepreneurs will fall off. But some entrepreneurs will survive. So there, what evangelicalism does and what the good news of neoliberal capitalism is to show these success stories and to give this aspirational myth that if some people can succeed, all people can succeed when the system is set up to fail for at least many people within it.
I know that another concern you have is that a lot of the focus for Bono is on getting high-level people of wealth to write very big checks. And I think this is a concern that you have as well, that in many cases he seems to be going after solutions that in a sense have very little to do with you and me, and instead have to do with famous people who can write really big checks. And not that that in and of itself, that there is anything wrong with that, but in a sense that there's maybe something wrong with making that so much of the focus.
Yeah, if you take a step back and look at in human history, have rich people ever solved poverty? I mean, it would be one cynical way to look at it, but has the sort of weight of history to back it. And I just think it's fascinating. I think it just requires a particular religious view to assume that wealthy people will just can solve the world's problems. And why would you think that it's in the interest of people who have a lot of money to end this, to challenge the system in a way that would threaten their ability to continue to make a lot of money? So if you look at an example like agricultural reform in Africa, I mean, Bono's model of agricultural reform, partnering with Jeffrey Sachs and the One.org campaign in his NGO nonprofit, is to use Monsanto, now Bayer, but has was Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is invested in one, and the Bill.org and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has tons of stock, had tons of stock in Monsanto. And then the engine of agricultural reform in Africa under that model is Monsanto. What does that say? That's elite. So that's elite-driven social change. And local farmers on the ground resist it. They said, we don't want this. We want something different. And so that organization tried to have conversation between Monsanto and local farmers. And that conversation continued until local farmers said, we don't want biotech. We want other systems of sustainable agriculture. And that's when the conversation stopped. And so if you look at the history of elites driving social change, there's always conversation until it threatens their ability to make the profit in the way they see fit.
I know that this also is probably speaking to another concern you have, which is that Bono, and he's certainly not alone in this, probably in some ways has a simplistic view of the continent of Africa, which is, of course, vast and widely varied. But like a lot of people, he tends to think of Africa as one thing and with one set of problems to be addressed. And it's probably very possible to do inadvertent harm if one does not appreciate the complexity of the story of Africa.
Exactly. And this, for me, is the sort of challenge of studying evangelicalism. It's not that you can say that Bono is a bad guy. It's a sense in which this desire to be good, which is really an evangelical desire to spread good news, to find good news in a world that's filled with darkness, is Bono's looking to Africa and saying this is our spiritual home as a human race, and that we're all connected to Africa. But the ways the language he uses it to describe Africans is very disconcerting because it's a racialized essence. He'll speak in the terms of Africans being genetically musical. He has spoken in interviews about showing up in LA in the 1980s and first hearing hip hop and rap and saying that to himself, this is genetically African music swimming upstream to African Americans. So there's this romantic idealism about Africans being noble, being genetically musical, by being inherently spiritual. And if you study the history of American religions, you'll see case after case in which really liberal, good-hearted people, white people, have seen Africans, and particularly Harriet Beecher Stowe, for example, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, who was an abolitionist who would be celebrated as, you know, fighting against slavery, also at the same time thought that blacks were unfit for governance, that they were better off in Florida, where they could be basically lazy, and saw them at the same time as saying those things as spiritually superior to whites, as having this spiritual essence that was beyond the ability of whites. And Bono says very similar things in economic terms. Africa, the Red Campaign is marketed outside of Africa, but not within it. There's this language of Bono to generate economy within Africa, but it's never on the terms of Africans alone. It's always demanding outside intervention from the West, whether it's in the old forms of aid that have now shifted to new forms of entrepreneurial work. But the engines of economic development in Africa are not from the local economy. It's from outsiders like multinational corporations like Monsanto, Bayer, these mining companies. So all of that is to just say you're exactly right on that point.
In our last minute or so, do you see any evidence that over the years Bono has come to reform any of his ideas or principles that cause you concern? I mean, is he learning? Are things pointed at in encouraging directions as far as you're concerned?
I think as a person who's grown up within the evangelical world, what I find baffling in a sense, or amazing to study and be, is just the ability to absorb critique without changing the underlying principles. So I would say that's very descriptive of Bono. Bono has absorbed critique, and this is true of evangelicalism, it's true of capitalism in general, without changing the very mechanisms underneath it. So Bono has listened to economists in Africa who have critiqued old forms of aid that have just been funneled money from Western nations into the nations within the continent of Africa. And he's listened to those critiques, but the one thing he has not changed consistently is the same thing evangelicals have never changed, which is this missionary desire to intervene from the outside and to help someone in need and to save that person. So once that language has begun, and Bono does it in economic terms, where there's a need for external intervention from these companies, multinational corporations based in Europe and the U.S., to intervene in Africa and to save people and to alleviate poverty, it's this, you're constantly, in religious language, creating someone other, different than yourself. So when we're talking about the language Bono uses of Africa, he sees all of humanity connected to Africa in the past, but then he'll speak of himself as white. He's not black. He's not African. So it's this, he's connected to Africa in the past, but not in the present. And so there's this missionary impulse to save the other, and that requires someone to constantly be in need. So there's this missionary desire to save someone creates a kind of built-in paternalism that doesn't ever go away. I think the only times things will change is to really have radical equality, in the sense of getting rid of those class distinctions of someone in need and someone who can help. Once we're all in the same group of being in need and helping each other, like collectively as a social collective, and not as some rich people from the outside helping poor people, then that's when things will change, if that's even possible.
The book is Religion Around Bono, Evangelical Enchantment and Neoliberal Capitalism, published by the Pennsylvania State University Press. The author, Chad Seals. Professor Seals, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book, and best wishes to you.
You're welcome, Greg, and thanks again for having me on the show.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm going to be catching up with several area clergy to whom I spoke right before Easter. At that point, we were talking about how they were planning to lead their respective congregations and parishes through the early days of the COVID-19 crisis. Now, as we find ourselves slowly but surely moving towards more openness, congregations and parishes are faced with the very tricky question of whether or not to resume live in-person worship. And if that in-person live worship is resumed, under what circumstances can it be done safely? We'll be talking with several different clergy from Southeast Wisconsin about that on tomorrow's morning show. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more at Carthage.